Hello, I'm Eddie Merckx. Welcome to the VeloCast.
Everyone, and welcome to another edition of the VeloCast. My name is Scott.
And I'm John. That was a bit heartfelt, that. Another edition of the VeloCast.
Yes, that's kind of how it is. Another day, another VeloCast. Hey, before we go any further, I take it you've seen the rather suspect tweet from Cycling Weekly.
Oh, I wasn't actually going to discuss this in case we appeared petty.
No, there's nothing wrong with petty. Petty's in fact, do you know what? Here's petty. I'll do the introduction again. Bonjour tout le monde et bienvenue à un autre épisode de la VeloCast qui aujourd'hui nous consacre à Cycling Weekly.
Okay.
Which is the normal introduction apart from which today we dedicate to Cycling Weekly.
Yeah, well, it really annoyed me, as you probably saw from Twitter.
I think it really annoyed a lot of people.
Yeah. Pretentious twats. I mean, how dare they proclaim themselves to be arbiters of taste? I mean, really? Have you read the comic?
I mean, apart from anything else, it's just ludicrous because, well, it's the...
You can't call a derailleur a derailleur. You can't call a peloton a peloton. You can't call a water bottle a bidon. Ridiculous.
And as I tweeted in the wake of it, look, it's quite frankly farcical because half the English language is actually French. So anyway,
it's print media with intimations of its own death. That's what that is.
Right. Rest day number one for the riders, not for us.
Not for us.
This year's Tour de France. And if nothing else, it gives us all time to take some stock of what's happened across the last week. We're not gonna talk too much about the last week of the Tour de France because we've been doing nothing else for the last week. But I just thought it would be a good idea to, I don't know, have a quick check on highlights thus far, so on and so forth.
Okay.
So your highlight of the week then? What's really stuck out for you since we kicked off in Rotterdam?
Cobbles. Cobbles.
Damn,
were fantastic.
That was mine.
No, that's all right. We can both have the same highlight.
Okay.
But my actual highlight was, and I'm going to get a dog turd in the post from Simon Lamb because of this, but it was Armstrong ride yesterday, having seen videos of the crash.
Okay, okay.
You know, the telly, it just looked like a normal, gentle shoot. Sorry, that's a French word for crash.
Which you're not allowed to use anymore.
No, absolutely not. But... there's a fan by the side of the road at the roundabout, you know, at the foot of the Col de la Ramaz, who captured the crash. And he goes down, I swear, 70 or 80 kilometres an hour. He goes down hard and he slides into a curb at least 12 metres away from the point of impact in the road. Now, anybody would have been, you know, nobody would have blamed him if they'd seen that video and he'd got into a team car. But instead, he did a first cat, a third cat, and another first cat climb, and only lost 11 minutes. You know, I don't care what we say about the man, that shows real, real dedication and real guts.
Well, going back to the Tour of California where he crashed, and I don't know if you've seen that video that was posted, quite a lengthy thing where it kind of goes across the 20 minutes or so between the crash and Lance actually abandoning. He had no clue as to what to do when he eventually came to the conclusion that he couldn't ride.
Because he was high on drugs.
Well, he just said, you know, I've no... What do I do? Where do I go?
No, I mean, seriously, I've been openly sceptical about his performances. You know, I'm one of the people who believes that anything above 6.2 watts per kilogram of body weight is some kind of indication of doping. And he's regularly, as have quite a few other people, going well past that. But that was just pure guts and willpower yesterday. And I hope he hangs out. You know, it'd be good to see him finish the race with some pride, even though he's completely out of it now.
Mm. Okay, then, since we both agree on, well, kind of both agree on the highlight of the week, that being the Pave, best rider of the week?
I think for me, you've got to say Fabian Cancellara, because he's been both the hero and the villain of the piece this week. You know, he was the leader of that farcical stage two, where everybody rode in and nothing counted. But he's also been, you know, a joy to watch during the prologue, and you know, a joy to watch over the pavé as well.
Simultaneous so, yellow jersey and water carrier.
Yeah, he's been, you know, and I just heard today actually that Reese has found some new sponsors. So he's likely to be carrying on with Reese next year, I would have thought. SunGuard, who were the second string sponsor this year, have stepped up a wee bit. And there's another sponsor who hasn't, you know, revealed yet.
Yeah, yeah.
But Cancellara was great. Geraint Thomas was incredibly impressive right up until the point when, you know, he got into unknown territory. Some of the others are looking a bit shaky, but thinking about it now, and I'm thinking on the hoof, you know, because we haven't done our normal show preparation because, you know, we're eight into the tour.
There aren't enough hours in the day.
No, and my wife will divorce me. But Andy Schleck, forget his performance yesterday when he won the stage, his performance on the pavé was unexpected and impressive.
Yeah, you've kind of taken, again, a couple of mine there. Schleck and Geraint Thomas, I thought, have been hugely impressive. Ryder Hesjedal, I thought, has been good this week as well.
Well, his great advantage is that he's virtually invisible. I mean, the T-Hag on the forum's going to join in with a Simon Lam post on something nasty thing, because she's
Canadian, yeah.
And she loves Ryder. But he's doing what Wiggins did last year. You know, Van de Velde is out the picture. So Garmin, once again, I've got a kind of stealth entry into the GC contenders, and he's, you know, he's stepped up to it. Well done.
Yep. Best team this week?
I'd have to say Saxo Bank.
Okay.
Just because of their performance during the, you know, during the first week, and that brilliant coup where they actually managed to get the race stopped when their two GC leaders were nowhere.
I would probably say worst team of the week then for that reason and that reason alone. I was going to say Astana for managing to cover up the fact that Contador was in oxygen debt yesterday.
Yeah. I don't know, did you read that tweet from, was it Sergio Paulino? Ewan on Twitter brought it to my attention, where he said, you know, just you wait, in essence, Sky, Astana and Garmin, you amateurs, you. He who laughs last will laugh longest. And I've actually got no idea what he's talking about.
Well, but, time will tell, I suppose.
I mean, I don't think Radio Shack were terribly impressed by the fact that you know, nobody waited when Lance crashed yesterday. But, you know, what goes around comes around, and it was just a racing incident. You know, it wasn't a mechanical, and it wasn't a weird crash like Ulrich into a ditch. So, you know, it was just a racing incident.
Quite. Biggest disappointment then?
I'm probably going to get, you know, be shown to be extremely wrong very soon, but Wiggins. Wiggins, for me, I was sceptical at the start, but I didn't expect to see him shelled so early. You know, just two first cats and a third cat climb, and he's a minute 40 back. Because they've been talking a good game, Sky, and they've had the resources behind them. So I expected a wee bit more of him. But, you know, he might come good. He might get better in the, you know, the next hills.
And the thin blue line in the toothpaste. For me, I think, probably the crash, actually, that took Armstrong out was probably the biggest disappointment. For no other reason that it kind of robbed us of the opportunity to see whether the old sod actually still had the legs to do it across 3 weeks.
It also robbed us of the opportunity to potentially see a changing of the guard. You know, but we'll never know now whether Armstrong would have been good or not.
Precisely that.
You know, and Brunel said that. He said, you know, Bert looked a bit weak today. And we'll just never know it. And I think it's robbed us of some spectacle. As I say, whatever you think of Armstrong, he brought a lot of attention to the race and a lot of speculation. So it's a shame he's out.
Right, okay. Right, while we're on the subject of Radio Shack, I think you wanted to talk briefly about another message on Twitter, this time from Chris Horner.
Well, I think Johan Brunel should take away their Twitter accounts, actually. Because you had Sergio Paulino spouting stuff that nobody understood in Spanish. Or is he Portuguese, actually? I think he might be Portuguese.
I think he's Portuguese.
Aye. And you had Chris Horner. Now, Brunel had earlier said, that's it, you know, the team's behind Levi. You know, we're behind him because he managed to stay with the leaders, which is true. He did. I mean, he stayed with the elite group. And Chris Horner was asked, so are the team going to get behind Levi? And he said, well, we'll support him, but you know, why would you put a team in the front for 8th position in the GC? Which isn't on message.
And that's being kind. I can imagine
it's a stupid thing to tweet.
I can imagine it's separate tables, if not separate dining rooms at dinner tonight between Chris Horner and Levi Leipheimer.
I don't think he'll be happy, but I think Radio Shack are going to concentrate on stage wins, because I don't think Leipheimer's got a chance in hell of winning the GC.
Well, we said that yesterday, but I mean, even the tweet in and of itself, I think whether Leipheimer has a shot at the GC or not, I think not, or being so bloody minded as to not realise that you put your team resources behind the highest place GC rider is kind of stupid, especially for a team that had ambitions of winning the thing.
Yeah, it was just like heat of the moment. I mean, because Horner's part of Armstrong's close cadre, although, you know, they had handbags at Dawn earlier in their careers, but you know, they should still have somebody controlling what they tweet.
Right, going back now to some news that broke in the opening days of the tour, but we've purposely set it aside until today. President of the International Cycling Union, Pat McQuaid, revealed to Cycling News that Lance Armstrong made not one but two donations to the UCI. Now, speaking to Cycling News during a visit to Britain, McQuaid said that the seven-time Tour de France winner signed a personal cheque for $25,000 in 2002, and then his management company, Capital Sports and Entertainment, made a second payment of $100,000 in 2005.
Let's just briefly summarise this, okay? I might be wrong, but Uncle Pat said not that long ago, when, you know, people were talking about the validity of the donations, actually, we're just a small, you know, a small organisation. We're strapped for cash, in essence, and we take money where we can get it.
He said that on the, now forgive me, I forget the name of the station.
Talk Radio.
It was Talk Radio, in the immediate aftermath, I think it was the day of, or the day after, when I think it was David Walsh was also on the programme. That was his exact comment. We'll take money from anybody.
Okay, so, small, take money from anybody, okay? So they're clearly a bit strapped for cash. So here we have an organisation which is strapped for cash, and its leading public face just now, he's forgotten about a 25 grand donation, which, I mean, I think I would remember that if it was a bit strapped for cash. Who forgot about a $100,000 donation until, you know, they went and chased it, because, oh, he's no paid up, we better go and chase it.
Well, see, that doesn't make sense to me in and of itself, because he said before that the remember when there was the questions, I think ahead of the Giro or during the Giro, there was a press conference where there was some confusion and details were coming to light over how much Armstrong had donated to the UCI. Some were saying 25, others were saying 100,000, others were saying way in excess of that. But he said that no, the confusion lay because Armstrong had pledged the money, $100,000, to the UCI after Lance Armstrong and Johan Bruneel visited the newly opened headquarters in Switzerland, and it took until 2005 for them to get the money because they had to chase it up. That fundamentally contradicts what Pat McQuaid has said to Cycling News last week.
The whole thing's just a mess. But my favourite bit was when Cycling News said to me, he whipped out the receipt for the seismic machine that they bought with the 100,000 minus a bit of change. He whipped out the receipt and showed it to Cycling News, and they said, can we take a picture of it? And he went, no, and stuffed it back into a dossier marked confidential. If he's out in the open, why didn't he let them take a picture of it? It's just a receipt.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, you can't defend your organisation from accusations of improper behaviour by saying, well, we've looked at this behind closed doors and we'll give you a wee glimpse of a bit of paper. And, well, you just have to trust us that everything is legal and above board. It's tantamount to saying, you know, I didn't do that bank job, Your Honour. I was at home on my own reading a book. But other than me telling you what happened in the book, you just have to take my word for it.
Yeah, exactly that. So do we think Lance got preferential treatment?
Well, Lance does get preferential treatment. Lance gets preferential treatment as soon as Pat McQuaid opens his mouth in an interview. I mean, I honestly, I don't think...
He's getting worked up, folks. Stand back from your microphone.
I don't think for a second that Lance Armstrong has actually received preferential treatment within the UCI. But all you need to do is compare and contrast comments made about any rider accused of doping. With,
you don't think he's received preferential treatment?
Not that I can see, but...
So why was he allowed to start the Tour Down Under last year without fulfilling the criteria for out of competition testing?
Right, I take all that back. He has received preferential
treatment. Which suspiciously coincided, and I think, you know, the bike.ie on the forum for pointing this out, with him agreeing to ride the Tour of Ireland, which is organised by somebody called McQuaid, but not Pat, I believe. He's had preferential treatment. And the other question that was raised, again by Derek, is... Why are the UCI buying a seismic machine? You know, they outsource all their testing. So why are they buying it? You know, is there only one?
And I
asked
you...
some testing, but not others?
Yeah, it's, and I asked
it's
you...
It's a
when
murky
you,
mess.
Murky, murky ladder.
Murky, murky mess.
I asked you when you brought that point up, has it always been the case that the UCI has outsourced their testing? And you said yes.
Well, they didn't have a machine before. You know, it wasn't to replace an old, you know, machine that was given up under the strain of all the dope testing they were doing.
Yeah. Well, there are other. Sorry, John. There are other aspects of this that worry me greatly. In an interview, Pat McQuaid also said there's more than Armstrong implicated. There's 8 or 10 guys mentioned. Why is everyone concentrating on Armstrong? Well, maybe because he's won more Tour de France than anyone else, and by your own admission, Pat, he's a, and I quote, world star. I mean, maybe the notion that the biggest name in professional cycling since Eddie Merckx has built his career on cheating is an erroneous one? Really? Honestly, Pat?
Should we move on before your high blood pressure starts to cause you problems?
It might be an idea. Well, also breaking just before the Tour, and I don't suppose there's any surprise there, was an interview in the Wall Street Journal with Floyd Landis titled Blood Brothers.
Yeah, that's not provocative at all, is it?
not in the lead, no. I mean, apart from an allegation, which we'll come to in just a moment, I don't think there was anything really new here. It was a reiteration of what the accusations are and put forward in a much more coherent sense.
Yeah, I mean, I thought exactly that. It clarified a lot of the stuff that had come through. I don't know if it's worth dwelling on much, because what I see around me is that already the lines are divided, in much the same way they were about whether Landis was innocent. You know, people either think he's a dirty doper who's a liar, or people think he's opening up the murky underbelly of cycling. It's interesting, though, that a lot of the people who were, how shall I put it, significant at the front of the blue train for US Postal in the mountains, and which were a surprise to us at the time, are getting dropped pretty early now.
Mm-hmm. Yep, fair enough. I mean, I thought it was significant, and I think this was on the Inner Ring website, saying that the reason this is significant from a broader perspective is that it puts the question of who Lance Armstrong actually is on the breakfast tables of Middle America. That the Wall Street Journal isn't a tabloid rag, and it's not a niche cycling publication.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely it. I mean, it brings it out into the open. And when we've talked briefly, Interpol are now getting involved. Rudy Pevenage has admitted that he organised trips for Ulrich to Fuentes, you know, a large number of trips. And the theory that's being, you know, widely espoused in essence is that after Festina in 98, allegedly, most of the peloton had cleaned up. And in fact, Pevenage says, you know, 99 telecom were more or less clean, but that, you know, a certain person restarted the arms race, if you like. Those are just allegations. But the fact there's a federal investigator who's now been appointed with, you know, with a decent backup team means we'll find out if they're true.
Yeah, I think it might take a few years before we ever find out if it's true.
Three or four years, I would expect.
At least. Well, one revelation that came from the Wall Street Journal interview was that Johan Brunel put US Postal team bikes up for sale, and that Brunel told Floyd Landis that the money raised would go towards funding the team's doping programme.
And Trek were aware of it.
This stems from March 2004 during Paris-Nice. Now, Landa said he was in a position to win the sixth stage when his bike frame snapped. Now, he said he blamed the mishap on the bike's carbon fibre, which he said had been weakened by wear and tear. Now, after the race, Landa recalled that he phoned Johan Breneel, then, of course, DS at US Postal, told him he needed a brand new bike. Now, according to Landis, Breneel told him that he didn't have enough equipment to allow every rider to always have new bikes. Now, Floyd Landis, being Floyd Landis, then spoke to Scott Dober, the rep at Trek.
Yep.
And Trek were somewhat surprised to learn that they were short of bikes, as they make 120 bikes a year for US Postal, and that the team was missing around 60.
Yeah, and Trek said, you know, that they were aware that bikes were being siphoned off, and that it was extremely regrettable because they should go where they were intended to, you know, for racing.
Yeah, they said that they would occasionally see a bike pop up on the internet somewhere, and it would surprise us.
Yeah, and a bike that I've seen them. I mean, we've all seen them. You know, Lance Armstrong team bike. They were getting $20,000. You know, that's a lot of honey stingers, or whatever the you know, the wee gel things he's eating just now. So there's that's got to beg some questions as well. You know, the most well-funded team are having to sell kit to do what?
Yeah.
And Trek themselves said, you know, they regretted it, and it's interesting that the answer came not from Trek, but through their lawyers.
Yeah, it came from Robert Burns, general counsel for Trek. And that surprised, I mean, I was absolutely stunned that Trek commented at all here. And as you say, that it didn't come from marketing or the head of Trek or whoever, but it came from the legal counsel. And you can only surmise that if the response comes from the legal counsel and declines to comment on whether they've been contacted by the federal investigators, that either they have been, or
they're expecting
a knock on the door very, very soon.
I mean, where did the money go? You know, it's next one. We'll look at another, and we'll cheer up shortly, because we, you know, we've been saving this up while we've been talking about the racing. I quite like Pat McQuaid, as do you.
Yes, I mean, as a person,
we'd love to sit and have a pint of Guinness with him in a pub.
Yes.
You know, he seems like a really personable guy who just shouldn't be in charge of the UCI.
I mean, I would like to think that there is someone in Switzerland, whenever Pat's interviewed, that, you know, has to press their fingers against the bridge of their nose and and they sigh, going, oh no, yeah, he's at it again. But you're only left with the notion that it's just idiots all the way down.
Well, yeah, I quite like Pat McQuaid, but before him there was Hein Verbruggen. Now, Hein Verbruggen, I'm pretty sure, sleeps in a coffin with dirt from his grave in it that he just shipped around the world. I mean, the man has been loathsome and objectionable on so many levels right through his career at the UCI. You know, from the debacle with Graham Abree, where, you know, it would take four or five podcasts to go through everything where they were making up rules on the spot because they decided they didn't like this, you know, boy from Scotland showing them the way. To so many farcical statements, but he's shown himself in a really, really bad light, you know. And again, at a point where he should be statesmanlike, even though he's retired, he's just shown himself to be a petty oaf.
Yeah, well, this comes from the New York Daily News, who reported last week that Hein Verbruggen, former head of the UCI and currently an honorary member of the IOC, sent Floyd Landis an email on June the 4th saying, "Mr. Landis, you are not worth any further word or attention except perhaps from psychiatrists." 2 days earlier, on June 2nd, Verbruggen taunted Landis, according to the New York Daily News, by sending a link to a sports writer's column that took Landis to task for having questioning the ethics of anti-doping agencies during the arbitration fight over his positive test 4 years earlier. It said, "I do not want to accept the risk that you would miss this article. After reading, you might, together with me, conclude that if being a nuisance to many people would be the main objective of your life, you succeed so well that you should still get a yellow jersey. This time, and in capitals, well deserved! !
Yeah, welcome back to Primary 7.
It does. I mean, in some in fairness of some description,
how can you be fair to that? That's despicable from somebody who claims to be acting in the best interests of the sport.
I totally agree. The only thing I would say as measure to that is we don't get to see what Floyd Landis himself said, either to provoke it or what was said in retaliation. But you're absolutely right. Regardless of what is being said to someone in Hein Verbruggen's position, he shouldn't be commenting like that.
No, just wrong. Anyway, we've had enough crap, and we get quite het up about the UCI, but we've been saving it up while we've been talking about the racing this year.
Yeah, bottling things up, it's not good for you.
It's not good. Shall we talk about some cheerier stuff?
Yes, Shelley Evans rounded off an enormously successful Giro d'Ombre by taking the final stage over Cervelo's Kirsten Wild and Giorgia Bronzini, and it was the third stage victory for the US national team, and that capped off Mara Abbott's overall victory.
I wish I'd seen more of this. I mean, I wish I had, but we've been a bit busy.
Yes, with a mild, somewhat insignificant race around France, I believe.
Which has been great, but I mean, this looked fantastic as well. I've only seen still shots, and it looked just as exciting as watching, you know, any decent high category men's stage race. And we've been rabbiting on about women's cycling all year this year. Emma Pooley finished fifth, just outside the top, you know, the top three. She's had a great year. But Mara Abbott, she won by, you know, 2 minutes.
Yes, held on to a 2:05 margin over HTC Columbia's Judith Arndt, and a further minute over world champion Tatiana Guderzo.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another sign that women's racing deserves to be taken seriously. And I'm sorry, it's an almost token thing here because we didn't see enough of it or follow it because, you know, our heads were full of the tour, which is to our detriment. It might appear like tokenism, but it's something we believe in, and it's something that we've featured, you know, for a long time in the Velocast, so we just thought it needed mention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was some consolation for Emma Pooley because she took the mountains jersey.
Yeah, I mean, she's been awesome this year.
Just final point there then, that last year's winner, Claudia Hausler, finished fourth, and the title of best young rider remained with Marianne Vos, who we've talked about a lot. She had the pink jersey for 2 days before conceding it to Abbott on Friday. Now, workers at the Cambridge Science Park can now use electric bikes to zip around under a free pool cycle scheme which started 2 weeks ago.
Which is very, very cool. You know, e-bikes are, they're coming to the fore. I noticed that Marcus Stork's incredibly high-end e-bikes and commuting bikes have now got a British importer, for example. So somebody's willing to take a risk. The guy who brought Scott into the UK initially is taking the risk on the high-end Stork e-bikes. So it's something that's happening. But Cambridgeshire County Council deserve, you know, they deserve some respect, or even, you know, a small chapeau in their direction.
No, you're not allowed to say that anymore.
And the project was launched recently with 15-minute test rides around the area. And what I like, I mean, this is a great reason. He thought the bikes would make it easier for staff to get around, you know, because it's a science park. You know, the streets will be quiet and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it would make them less sweaty too.
Well, that's important.
No, it really is. I mean, I wish I could be less sweaty when I ride around. I just saw it and I thought it's another sign that e-bikes are being taken seriously. There's some momentum gathering behind them, and it's good because for normal people, or for, you know, for less fit people, or, you know, for thrill seekers, which my pick of the week will expose slightly, it's happening. You know, it's genuinely happening. And, I mean, with the likes of, you know, the Fisher Collection, you know, in the Trek catalogue, Marcus Stort stuff, and, you know, the Go Cycle, it's happening. As I say, the designs are getting better, the batteries are becoming more efficient, you know, Shimano and SRAM are getting involved with fully integrated e-bike drive trains. A year from now, we'll be wondering what all the fuss was about, and, you know, we'll be seeing lots of them in countries with a good bicycle education, unlike Britain.
Unlike us, yeah, unlike us indeed. Aye. Now, offering a unique way for potential buyers to view properties is Pedal to Properties, which is a full-service real estate company that allows customers to tour neighbourhoods via cruiser bicycles.
Again, you know, it's a gimmick, but it's a cool gimmick. In an area where the houses are close together, you wouldn't have to worry about parking. You'd get a feel for what the area was like for your kids, you know, if you were moving to a home with kids. So it's not a bad idea. It's a gimmick, but it adds some depth to how the feel you'd get to the neighbourhood. So I think it's a good idea.
I don't know if it's. I would go as far as to say it's a gimmick, because I mean, we've talked long and if not ad nauseum about how being on a bike offers a completely different experience to being behind a couple of tons of steel and glass in a car, that you get to see the countryside or the environment from a completely different vantage point. And I honestly think seeing a neighbourhood by bike is a wholly different experience to seeing it, you know, just driving to a house you're thinking of buying and then driving away again.
No, I'd actually agree. I genuinely agree. I mean, there are some areas of Edinburgh where I wouldn't want to go and see them by bike.
But you wouldn't be wanting to be buying a house there anyway.
No, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, well done.
Okay, well, you can find out more information on that at pedal2properties.com. Okay, this now is a bizarre series of photos spotted at the Cyclicious website showing bikes as transportation and shields during the recent G20 summit meeting in Toronto.
Carlos Barredo must have been looking at this when he grabbed that front wheel to scalp
somebody.
Do you know,
actually, this reminded me of something, or Carlos Barredo, that fight during the week reminded me of something, and it was exactly this.
Now, this is what I was talking about. Do you remember after that I said that you can use your bike as an instrument of self-defence?
Right.
And these officers are getting on with it, but is it just me, or does this picture, it looks like the setup for a slightly kinky gay porn film?
Again, the comments made by John Galloway are not those of the
look at the first picture where they've got their work belts on. It's like the village people go cottaging.
I can't believe, you know, I need to make you aware, you are saying this out loud. This isn't the internal dialogue that you normally have.
I don't think I'll be welcome in Toronto.
Actually, do you know what? I agree with you. It is the village people doing anti-terrorism.
I mean, I'm all for using bicycles around, particularly for the police, because we've raved about how manoeuvrable, how fast through traffic, how they're not limited to roads. So if they're tracing a suspect across a park, for example, they can just get off the pavement and onto the park. But that picture, it does. It just looks like you ordered 12 policemen, sir. We're here to fill your needs.
Oh, no, that's not a phrase you want to be using.
It's wrong.
To be honest with you, as useful as it may be, I think I'd much rather have a toughened Perspex riot shield if it's all the same to you. I can't really see the front wheel of a chunky tired urban bike being that useful when faced with a barrage of half bricks and Molotov cocktails.
No, but well done for being green, lads.
Now, Paul Harris of Canadian bike distributor KMI has joined forces with an experienced bike designer, dedicated urban commuter and mountain biker Jerome Roy, to create an A to B machine that's fun to ride called the Urbana Bicycle.
I think we might actually have talked about this in the past briefly, but this is the first pictures I've seen of it, complete. The basket in the back is mega. I mean, you could give your child a bath in the back of that.
But I could have a bath in the back of that.
Well, actually, you probably could because you're a munchkin. But the important thing about this is you're going to have a lot of weight high up on that rack, and the rack's designed to support that weight. So anybody that's had a kid in a child seat knows that weight high up on a bike makes mounting and dismounting the beast really hard. I mean, you'll know that taking your lad around the town.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the really low step-through height of this means it's a piece of duff even with a heavy load to get on. The whole thing's weatherproof, quite stylish, and with brakes that'll stop you in any conditions, so you're not relying on crappy brakes. Big balloon tyres mean you could go from dirt to gravel. It's just a really good solution for urban cycling.
Yeah, it certainly is. The review, which was excellent, I have to say, on the Commute by Bike website, did say that the kickstand, which is an optional extra, probably is somewhat of a necessity, as just due to the way the bike's designed, it's going to fall over really easily. But that was really just about the only negative thing I could see. And I agree with you, John. It's a cracking looking thing.
£120 load capacity in that basket.
In the basket,
you could go inside
I could have a bath in there, no problem.
It's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing.
Yeah, no details on price yet, as it only seems to be available through some dealers in Canada. But they do say that they're working on US distribution at the moment. And if you want to find out more information, you can get it at urbanabikes.com. Now, ahead of this year's Tour de France, BMC Racing posted a video where Andy Rees talked about their new Impec road bike, where they say robots are used to weave each tube individually rather than lay up sheets of pre-woven carbon fibre.
Yeah, they are. And it makes a... Actually, in standard BMC black and red colours, it makes a very handsome bike, but it also makes what I think is the ugliest bike at the Tour de France, which is George Hincapie's... in fact, he might still be riding an SLX-01, so I'm not sure. I might be doing the Impec a disservice. I think it might just be the bag of washing that's in the Impec. But, I mean, George, the BMC that Hincapie's riding is fugly. I mean, it's just really, really ugly. But the Impec... It did well with Cadel on top of it. They're talking about it being an innovative way to construct bikes. It isn't. You know, Time have been doing it for ages. And you're not allowed to call the lugs lugs. You have to call them shell nodes, which...
I don't know, it makes me laugh. I don't know why, it just made me laugh there.
I mean, I'd still have it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I know. Cadel even said the bike is absolutely perfect and is the best bike he's ever ridden.
I think he's paid to say that.
He might have been paid to say that. I also love that, I mean, I know that you spoke about this and you said, look, Time have been doing this for ages. I love the idea that it's robots that make it, which does give me images of Danger Will Robinson.
The other thing is, you know, robots, it just means it's more consistent. You can still have a consistently made crap design. And I don't think the BMC Impec is that. I mean, it looks like a gorgeous bike, but... you know, we're getting to marketing speak now with all these things. And I get the feeling with BMC, it's a lot like GT of old and Pinarello with their Dogma. The exaggerated nature of their lugs, it's all about visual identification in a fast-moving race. You know, they will make up arguments about function, but I think a lot of it is, and this has happened since the 50s, you know, with the rally fork and that sort of thing. I think a lot of it is, we've made a really good bike amongst loads of other really good bikes, so how can we make it stand out? And, you know, chapeau to them. Sorry, I'm doing it on purpose
just doing,
now.
Yeah, you're just doing it on purpose.
It's an attractive bike. It'll ride like a dream. And it seemed to do okay under Cadel.
Certainly. Now, Scott Bikes also released some new tech for the Tour in the form of the Project F01 for Team Columbia HTC.
See, this I actually got quite excited about because it mentioned the word aerodynamic.
Which is normally one of your buttons.
I start quivering. They're using something that's very, very similar an idea to the Camtail that we talked about with that really ugly
Trek. Yeah, yeah.
Where essentially what they do is they take a deep profile aerodynamic tube and cut it off and hope to retain some of the aerodynamic benefits by shaping the airflow over the front of the tube. With the Camtail, there's some good science behind it. To me, and this is where a lot of aerodynamics proves to be counterintuitive, because something can be shown to work in a wind tunnel, but just look wrong. And for me, this Scott makes a beautiful bike, but they've cut the tube profile so short that part of me is worrying about the turbulence. You know, once you've formed shaped the air at the front, how do you control it when it leaves the back of that really truncated wing form? So I'm not sure about the aerodynamic claims, but you can't argue with it being a horny bike. I mean, did you see Mark Cavendish's Ninja version with the blood splatters
on it? No. Well, according to Scott, they say that the Project F01 is not only faster and more aerodynamic than either the Cervelo S3 or the Felt AR, but also substantially lighter and more efficient under power.
It's only what, 20 or 30 or very slightly heavier than the, you know, their cutting edge Addict was, I think.
I think they said 5% heavier, but it reduces frame drag by 20 to 30%.
And that, I mean, that's hugely significant at the speeds people are racing at now. And it's one of the features we picked up in Eurobike last year when we were actually talking about the Cervelo and in fact, last year's Scott or the Felt, even on non-time trial bikes now. The speeds are so high and the riders are so close that any small advantage they can get, they're going to go for. And this looks like a nice bike. I mean, it's a hornier bike than the Impec, I think.
Yeah, they say that the F01 is still work in progress and there's no firm release date or target price just yet. Scott, team equipment manager, Herman Pakal, says it'll almost be a 2012 model, though the company may offer a very limited release as a 2011 bike. I mean, I can't really say anything more. I think it's a case of, for more information, go ask Mark Cavendish.
You have to ask, you know, whether they're or how they're allowed to ride them, because, you know, that sounds like a development bite to me. I mean, the UCI notes say you can't do that; it's not commercially available yet.
Well, that would contradict the fact that the Specialized Shiv is commercially available, but they can't ride it professionally.
That's a huge can of
an industrial size can of worms there. Now, a major revamp to the XTR range for 2011 will see the top of the line mountain bike Grupo from Shimano arrive in 10 speed form to complete the much vaunted XX offerings from SRAM.
Well, 10 speed, yeah, well done. Been running it for ages and my mountain bike works fine. Yeah, took a while, Shimano. And I don't mean I've been running SRAM. I mean, regular listeners will know I've just been running, in essence, I used the IRD 10-speed mountain bike cassette and some downtube shifter or some bar end shifters, Dura-Ace 10-speed bar end shifters. The things work flawlessly.
I thought we were in take a drink territory there, but
no, I'm not going to mention
you
it. I'm
skipped
not
around
mention
the side
it.
Of it.
Aye. What I will say is, it's nice to see some credible competition for SRAM XX.
Well, I think they had to.
It's a lovely looking Grupo. It's a lovely looking Grupo. Yeah. And I love Shimano. I've always used Shimano on my personal bikes. I mean, always. And whilst I flirted with going to SRAM, particularly when Red came out, I thought, oh, that looks nice. I'm going to stick with Shimano. It's never let me down. It works well. And XTR means, you know, you don't have to put up with just having 9 years. I mean, how 20th century is that?
Well, I mean, as I said a moment ago there, I think they have to. We've talked about the inexorable rise of SRAM since we started this show.
I tell you, an interesting thing for me, though, I mean, talking about having to, I was thinking about this today because I was looking at the new Campag updates for Centaur and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Campy on their high end have been 11 speed for ages now, and nobody's felt the need to chase them.
But I think
is 10 enough?
I think Campy exists in that territory that you buy with your heart, not with your head, and that's nothing against Campagnolo stuff. It kind of comes back to what I was saying about, you know, the rise of SRAM, that it seems to be worrying Shimano a whole lot more than it's worrying Campy, because people buy Campy, as I say, with that.
Right, for religious
reasons. For religious reasons, yeah, very, very well put, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but Shimano did have to catch up with SRAM and this XTR Grupo. It looks lovely. It weighs ballpark figure. I'd have it.
Say no more. You can find out more information at cycle.shimano-eu.com. Now, also arriving in 2011 is the all-new Specialized Amira women's road bike, which is a carbon fibre race machine with size-specific tubing, aggressive geometry, and top shelf spec. By that, I think they mean it's high-end equipment rather than it being covered in softcore pornography.
It's a top shelf bike. Actually, it kind of is, because it's quite sexy. This really, really chuffed me to see it. I mean, just as we're banging on about women's racing, you've got to give Specialized some credit. They've always had women's bikes prominent in their line. But the top-end road bikes, like the Ruby, for example, were always just that step back from the real cutting-edge stuff. The Amira, it's just a good, fast, high-end road bike made without compromise. And as such, I give Specialized credit. They're taking women's cycling seriously. The professional side of that sport is going, you know, is rising in popularity. If you were looking at a bike, whether you're a man or a woman, and you find two bikes that fit equally, the fact that Specialized have a really high end, no compromise women's bike, as a man, would make me far more likely to buy the man's bike. And for a woman, if they're taking you seriously and it fits, give them the support they need.
Yeah, to keep making the bikes, yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no details on price yet, but I'd imagine with...
Oh, no, if you have to ask.
Exactly, given it's Dura-Ace, integrated S-Works crank, so on and so forth. It's not going to be cheap. Right.
Well, the important thing, though, and I mean, this is worth mentioning, is it's not just a regeometry Roubaix, for example. You know, there's loads of wee changes to take account of the different way that women, you know, the centre of gravity is based on a bike. So it's not just tokenism with geometry. They've actually designed the thing from the ground up to be a, a really good race bike for a woman.
Yeah. Now, if this doesn't get you excited, then please stop listening to this show right now. There is, valued subscriber, no hope for you. The mouth-watering prospect on offer is, of course, that Cinelli is to reissue its Laser track bike from the 1980s.
I don't think we need to say anything more about that.
Right, let's move on.
I mean, it's the specialised Shiv of its day, except it's bloody gorgeous.
It is. I mean, I knew straight away that you'd want one of these.
I'd sell a child for that.
I was about to ask, which one of your three children are you going to sell to get one?
That's gorgeous, that is. You know, and again, it shows there's nothing new in cycling. Look at the front end of that. It's a Shiv.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful bikes in cycling have existed for a long, long, long time. Now, the important thing is these are being built by Andrea Pacenti, who we've talked about on the show before. And we raved about how good his steel bikes looked. And he made that stupid 720-gram scandium thing as well. Mm-hmm. So it's an icon from a company who are iconic themselves, built by somebody that, you know, even the Velocast have noted as one of the prime builders in Italy, which is high praise indeed. I mean,
indeed.
Let's face it, it's not worth building a bike unless you get over people. So, I mean, just look at it. Seriously, just look at it.
Yes, go have a moment, have several moments with it. Of course, it's going to be limited edition, and again, if you need to ask the price, you probably can't afford it.
Dude, our PayPal account's getting emptied. We're not going to Europe. No, I'm going to have one of these and do a runner.
And I wouldn't blame you for it. Now, as the website says, the 3 Rencho is your best buddy when you have a flat. Unlike your other friends, the 3 Rencho is made of heat-treated steel, removes 15mm axle nuts, and can pry tyres off their rims. You don't know my friends, but anyway.
Well, you know, real men don't need tyre levers anyway. But
Not a real woman before we go down that line.
No. It is a good... Actually, you should practice. It's a good party trick to mount and remove tyres without tyre levers. It always impresses you and gets you beers. I got this, actually, because I was looking at the Cinelli Laser. And it got me thinking about fixies. Because we've talked about fixies a lot, you know, fixie culture and, you know, strange people in three-quarter length trousers and that sort of thing. This and a puncture kit and a pump are all you would need to carry on your fixed gear bicycle. It's an elegant wee thing. It just works. You know, it's form, it's design, it's beautiful.
Yes, priced at $25, you can buy it and find out more information at ridepdw.com.
Apparently it treats rims like a tender lover if you get the coated one. That's a phrase that, there's so many things wrong with that phrase. I don't want to start there.
Images haunting me in the wee small hours, etc, etc. Now, new from Race Face are a series of 3 bottom bracket adapters for road and mountain BB30s, but with interior bearing diameters to fit their X-type cranks.
See, this is really interesting. Because we talked about somebody making an external bottom bracket for Shimano. And there are so many standards now, and so many good, not that old things kicking about, that for somebody like Raceface to provide adapters so that you can take your BB30 and convert it to convert it to fit an older crank. It's good to see. I mean, I've been looking at frame sets for... Actually, just... You know, I was dreaming and I was having a look, and most of the frame sets I liked, if I was going to buy a new bike just now, have a BB30 bottom bracket. However, in my shed, I've got a perfect Dura-Ace chain set. Buy your Race Face adapter, Bob's your uncle, job's done.
Yeah, it seems like a fantastic idea and not too expensive either. And you can find out more about that at raceface.com.
Tell you, as a mechanic, what I really like is clearly on every single adapter, it's got printed what model, you know, whether it's mountain or road, and the crank it's compatible with, and the bottom bracket shell, it'll fit. You know, it's just, if you're a mechanic, you stock three of these things, you've covered a lot of bases.
Yeah, definitely. Now, to explain some of the inner workings here at Velocast Towers for a moment, across the course of any given week, John and myself save stories for possible inclusion in the upcoming show using Google Wave. Now, the link to this next item was titled Scotty Ware. And it was on a fashion collection from a designer called Tom Brown, who had used the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France as inspiration for his collection. I have one thing to say. My friend John Galloway, you are a cheeky git.
Actually, both I and your erstwhile bassist during your career as a rock star, Steve McCluskey, independently found this and mentioned your name, so you can call both of us cheeky gits.
I shall be taking it up with McCluskey whenever I see him next. I mean, this
makes Rafa look like base level functional garmentry.
Actually, what I was going to say is it looks like a 9-year-old girl has been dressing up her Ken doll with the scraps from the Rafa factory.
Fucking ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It is. I mean, grey flannel shorts with white knickers that have a repeating pattern of bikes all over them. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm as metrosexual as the next man, but no. Just no.
No, I mean, it's an insult to the Vigorelli Stadium. It really is.
I mean, I'd rather attach electrodes to my nether regions than wear any of this. And I challenge Tom Brown, if he really believes that this collection is, you know, what people can wear in the street, then go attend, I don't know, a Rangers Celtic football match in Glasgow and see how long
maybe
you last.
Maybe during Mardi Gras or something.
Pardon?
Maybe during Mardi Gras or something.
I think even you would draw some looks at Mardi Gras, let's face it.
It's ridiculous.
Right, I think it's probably time for some picks of the week.
There's a boy there got cycle clips on and no trousers.
I said, I think it's probably time for some picks of the week. I don't want to dwell on this any further.
Okay, you go first.
Okay, well, I mentioned the website earlier on, The Inner Ring, and Matt, who writes that blog, which is excellent. I definitely encourage everyone to read it, posted a great piece a couple of weeks ago on, we've mentioned them as well, Sartorial Gobshites Rafa and their commemorative Tourmalet jersey. Now, for those that don't know, a bit of background here. The Tourmalet is one of the highest mountain passes in the Pyrenees, and it was added to the Tour de France in 1910. And the story goes that the organisers of the tour, the newspaper Lotto, sent Alphonse Staines to see whether the race could actually go across the Pyrenees or not. Now, he made his way up the Tourmalet, but conditions were so bad that he ended up needing rescuing himself. Now, for reasons best known to him and only him, he then sent a telegram to Paris saying that the road was, and I quote, perfectly passable. Now, of course, it being 1910, this is the 100th anniversary, and the tour itself will pay tribute to that with
bagging
over the Tourmalet twice. Yeah. Now, Rafa, always ready to evoke the legends of cycling, have a new jersey to revive this tale. Now, as they put it, the chest of the jersey is embroidered with a Tourmalet logo. Beneath it, in French, is Alphonse Staines' famous assessment of the mountain, parfaitement passable. Only they've cocked it up. Staines.
What is it? Is this Velocast a French grammar lesson?
Yes, it is going that way. Well, it was a French grammar lesson from Matt at the Inner Ring. I'm merely repeating it. Staines never wrote parfaitement passable. He wrote in the immortal telegram the words parfaitement praticable. So what that means is that the slogan adorning the front of the Rafa jersey actually translates as perfectly average. I think that says it all.
No, I like that.
So that's my pick of the week, the Rafa Tourmalet jersey, which is a complete cock-up.
I've got to say that the Velocast jersey looks far more attractive and is made of the same stuff.
Of course it does.
And it's, you know, it's made in Yorkshire by women.
Real Yorkshire women at that.
Aye, absolutely. Unavailable just now, but we'll be doing another run soon due to extra demand.
Hey, okay, your pick of the week.
Now, I'm going to mispronounce this because Americans make up the pronunciation for their names. I mean, let's be blunt. So, it could be the Hanebrink, but I think it's probably Dan Hanebrink. And I've been aware of his bikes for ages. He builds extreme terrain bicycles, which are essentially You know the Surly Pugsley?
I do indeed, yes. A fine bike.
It's like that on steroids. he makes them with huge, small diameter, but huge volume and low pressure tyres, so you can ride over any terrain you like. He's got a triple crown fork that would, you know, make a motorbike look a bit weedy. And for ages, I've always thought these look like great fun, but they must be a pig to pedal. So, because we want to support e-bikes, I thought I'd mention the new Henbrink all-terrain electric bike. Now, unlike your slightly woozy electric bikes, this has a 600-watt brushless electric motor, which drives dual-range 14-speed gearing.
And your washing machine, if you choose.
Top speed of 40 miles an hour. It delivers a runtime of 1 hour of continuous use in the streets and up to 1.5 hours off-road. Henbrink himself says he often goes longer than that by pedalling a bit more. And they are very pedalable. I mean, I was surprised. The video shows that. So if you want to ride anywhere on a pedal-powered machine and have electric assistance, which, you know, it might help you pull a load or it might just help you ride up a 45-degree hill, you know, and have fun on a sand dune, have a look at the Henbrink all-terrain electric bike. It's a nice kind of counterpoint to the super light, super fast machines we're seeing in the tour just now. And it's a bargain, only $7,650.
Sorry, there must have been something wrong with my headphones there. I thought you said 7,000.
I did.
Oh, okay.
Aye. Well, it looks worth every penny. I'm serious, you know.
It looks properly insane, but strangely cool with it.
Have a look at the video. It's brilliant. I love this. It's one of the things I love about cycling is the diversity. You know, on one end you've got BMC designing their Impec or Specialized designing their Shiv or Pacenti rebuilding the Cinelli Laser. And at the other end you've got, you know, Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome with an electric engine. It's fantastic.
Definitely. Well, I think that's probably all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening and staying subscribed. You can contact us by visiting our website at velocast.co.uk, where you can also find out how you can donate or subscribe to the show. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider leaving a comment or review in iTunes, as this really helps other people discovering it. Well, we hope you can join us tomorrow following the next stage of the Tour de France, which is set to be the most challenging in the Alps, for another edition of the Velocast.